Good evening. I'm Terry Orme. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, and I'm pleased to introduce to you tonight three journalists who I'm very proud work at our newspaper, the Salt Lake Tribune. The first is Nate Carlisle. Nate has been a Justice Desk reporter for about a decade at the Tribune, and 3 years ago, he took over the polygamy beat, and since then has done excellent award-winning work covering those communities in Utah and throughout the West. I'd also like to introduce Trent Nelson, a photographer at the Salt Lake Tribune, who has documented polygamy communities for a decade. He's taken us to Hilldale in Colorado City. He's taken us up to British Columbia. He's taken us to Texas and taken us inside these communities and shown us images that are pretty rare. The third journalist I'd like to introduce tonight is Jennifer Napier Pierce. Jennifer is the host of Trib Talk and will be conducting the interview tonight. Every day at noon at sltrib.com, Jennifer interviews some of the most interesting people, the most important newsmakers in Utah, and I invite you to tune in Monday through Friday, 12:15 on sltrib.com. And right now, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Napier Pierce.
Thank you so much, Terry, and thanks to everyone for being here at the City Library. Thanks to KCPW for broadcasting this for those who are in our listening audience, as well as streaming live video at sltrib.com. We're talking about Short Creek. We're talking about polygamy in Short Creek tonight. And for those who don't know, Short Creek is the historical name of two towns on the Utah-Arizona border. You can see the dramatic backdrop of this of these two towns, the dramatic red rocks. On the map, you can see that these towns really straddle the southern border of Utah and Arizona. Now, both of you have been covering polygamy for years. And I've lived in Utah for a very long time. I've zipped past Hilldale and Colorado City, but I've never actually stopped. And I suspect that there are a lot of people in our audience haven't been there either. So describe the look and feel of this town. Trent, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Colorado City and Hilldale are very similar to a lot of small towns you're going to find in Utah, except that the community, the majority community there, lives a very private lifestyle. And so you'll see a lot of big homes and walls and big families. But it definitely has a feel of a small town, but then there's just stuff that's a little off. And usually you go down there hearing these stories that you're going to get followed around, that you're going to get chased out of town, or that people are giving you the weird look. So you kind of go down with this kind of thing in your head that you're on an adventure anyway. But after spending, you know, making several visits, you realize you kind of get the feel for it, and you kind of understand how things work down there, and that kind of goes away pretty quick, that kind of stigma there.
Is there a main street?
Not a main street, no. I mean, there's a couple bigger thoroughfares off of the state highway that runs past there. There's not a commercial district or business district or anything like that. So it's definitely strange in that regard. I would say that in some ways it's better than it was when I started going down there about 10 years ago. Some ways it worse being I do get a lot more middle fingers aimed at me now than I did 10 years ago. On the other hand, there's also a lot more people that are willing to talk to me because so many people have left the FLDS in the last 10 years, or have at least stopped following Warren Jeffs. We need to kind of draw a distinction between people who say they've left the FLDS and people who've left Warren Jeffs, because some will tell you they still are FLDS, they just don't follow Warren Jeffs anymore.
So they've disavowed him as the leader. What was it like the first time that you went, Trent? Do you
have some
memories?
I went down the first time in 2005, and I was by myself, and back then there was no cell phone coverage, so I was out on these back roads just feeling like if something happens to me, no one's ever going to know where I am or what's going on. And it's really easy for them to identify you as an outsider, the vehicle you're driving or just how you look, what you're wearing. So people were kind of running away, or I really wasn't getting anything other than pictures of no trespassing signs, which are plentiful, and so forth. And by the end of the day, I found I was just worn out, and it, most of it was in my head, like I've said. It just, you kind of work yourself up. And I found this spot where I'm just like watching this side street, and I'm waiting for someone to walk by or something so I get a photo. And this pickup truck comes by with three guys in it, and they give me the meanest look I've ever, you know, just as they slowly pass, just staring me down. And they go left, and I go, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm done. So I go down, I go right, and then they're right on my tail. And they basically followed me all the way to the highway, and I could see them in the rearview mirror on a radio, you know, talking to whoever. And I was just wigged out. I was like, I'm out of here, I'm done. But it kind of hooks you in. And that's the only time I felt that way. That's like makes a good story. But a lot of journalists go down and they get caught up in this adventure, like, wow, they're going to chase me and they're going to follow me around. But that goes away pretty quick. And there are instances like this image here where we were with an investigator who is being followed. There's church security group who follows around in these big pickup trucks with tinted windows. And recently, you know, that's kind of toned down a little bit. There's now a series of more surveillance camera system to watch the town, as you can see in this image. There are a number of these cameras where they can kind of monitor what's going on in town without following you. But there are spots in town at the Bishop's Storehouse or the Meeting House. If you go and park, or if I go and park near those with my camera out the window, pretty soon there's a truck that'll pop up and kind of keep an eye on me. But I want to balance it out by saying you do realize after a while they're just watching. They're just keeping track. There's a little intimidation there probably, but there's never been an incident where you're in danger.
Do you have a first visit story, Nate?
My first visit was with Trent in it's either late 06 or early 07, so it's winter. It's pretty cold down there, and the way I got covering this in the first place was I was covering police misconduct at the Tribune, and at the time Utah and Arizona were trying to decertify a couple of the marshals down in those towns, take away their police powers, and so I went down there to work on a story about that. And I spent a day or so with Trent, and we were actually chasing the cops. We were trying to catch up to the marshals to ask them questions, get them to talk to us.
Role reversal, huh?
Yes, they're actually running from us. But there was hardly anybody at all in the towns that would talk to us back then. We didn't have, so many people were still loyal to Warren at the time. We didn't have many sources. It's very different in that way now. There's so many people out that it's much easier to find someone to talk to, unless of course they're still in the FLDS, then they won't talk to us. But one thing about the cameras, remember when you and I went to go interview the former town manager here in, I think it was September, and there's so many cameras all around town, and we go to meet this guy, and this guy used to run Hilldale as the town manager, and he since has left Warren and is now confessing to some of the things he did on the church's behalf when he ran the town. And we say to him, because we're going to eat lunch while we interview, and I say to him, well, we can go to Cottonwood Park or Maxwell Park. And then half joking, I go, which one has fewer cameras? Deadpan, he says, Maxwell Park.
That's great. That's great. Before we go any further, I want to show an image that you shared with me earlier today of a tombstone that is in a cemetery in Hilldale.
Yeah. This is there's just a sliver of FLDS with the surname Carlisle, spelled the same way as mine. And so once in a while, and I get asked if I'm related to Elmo Carlisle. And I'm not, unless, of course, you follow us back to Scotland, right, or something like that. And I'm sure he was a lovely gentleman. But I always thought this was the greatest headstone, and you can. This is one of the first headstones you see when you roll into that cemetery in Colorado City. And Trent took this photo, but it's the radio. So do you want me to read the epitaph, or do you want to do it? I got to turn around. The epitaph reads: "This is Elmo John Carlisle. He found the way the prophets went." And then it says, "When the prophets say it, you just have to believe."
Period.
Period.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a good segue into the FLDS Church. It really dominates both of these communities, and it has, well, it's the reason for their founding in this particular place. I guess to really understand the lifestyle, you have to understand the church. So can you sketch out what some of the major FLDS beliefs and doctrines are, Trent?
I mean, I'll start out and throw out a few things that I've noticed over the years, and Nate, fill in. But one like this, some of these images you see, is obedience is a key belief, but also secrecy. And that's due to their lifestyle basically being illegal. You can't live an illegal lifestyle out in the open.
It's based in polygamy.
Right. So there is a lot of don't talk to strangers, don't engage with the outside world, and now it's gotten to no music, books, movies. Internet is out, so it comes down to a lot of obedience. It's also very family-oriented in a way. Nate, you?
Yeah, they also believe in a communal form of living, and in a few ways, and we're going to talk later about the property trust, I think, that owns most of the real estate in the town.
If you see the image, I mean, these homes are huge. They're almost like apartment buildings.
Yeah, and technically, the state of Utah owns most of them at the moment, but we'll talk about that later, I think. So they believe in this communal form of living, and then since about 2010, they've increased that. Warren Jeffs created what he calls the United Order, which the term United Order has some history in Mormonism, but not the way Jeffs has quite used it either. Everyone's required to consecrate everything to the church now, and
everything
they have to I've been told, right down to how many toothbrushes you have in the house. You have to at least turn in a kind of a ledger of what you have in your house to the church. And the FBI raids and arrests last week, that was one of the issues, that the to be in the United Order, if you were on food stamp benefits, you had to turn in your debit cards to the church, and the church was using them to either run them through at some church-controlled stores, and the stores would keep the cash, and they'd find their way to the church or some other expenses, or they'd gather up all the cards, go to Walmart, Costco, and buy a bunch of food and other supplies, and then would take it back to the FLDS storehouse. Either of those things are in violation of the terms of food stamp benefits, and so that led to the indictments that were unsealed last week.
We'll get to that in just a minute. Go ahead, Trent.
One further thing about FLDS beliefs, what they will tell you, and they have told me repeatedly, is their religion, what they will say is, we follow the Joseph Smith, Brigham Young Mormonism up until the Polygamy Manifesto. So that's how they would relate it to people in Utah. Now, there have been some changes. They have a prophet, and they've had, you know, three prophets in the last little while: Leroy Johnson, Rulon Jeffs, and now Warren Jeffs. Those prophets have made some changes, but they would tell, in their own words, they would say, "We're Mormons. We just, you know, the church went wrong. The LDS church went wrong. We stayed with the true beliefs." That's what they would say.
Okay, the pure form of Mormonism.
Right.
It does seem to govern every element of life in Short Creek, though. I mean, what's it like for kids growing up in this community?
Well, for kids, there's good things you can see in there, and then there's things that are a little more troubling. But you think about growing up in a small town. A lot of us remember, like, Andy Griffith Show, Mayberry. These rural towns are really a great place for kids. You can see playing, you know, just playing with whatever's out there. You've got a lot of kids around, a lot of brothers and sisters, cousins, friends. So, like, there are these really neat social elements for children. But as kids get older, there've been rules, like recently, like here, this shot of the basketball courts covered up with recycled materials because competitive sports have been, you know, basically it's a no-go. A few years ago when the UO started, they sold all the bikes, and toys are kind of, you don't really see toys.
United Order.
There's kind of, and then as you get to be a teenager in this community, I mean, education is a whole other issue. Education seems to be not up to what we would want it to be. But But as you get to be a teenager, there's a separation of boys and girls, as you see, kind of this picture kind of illustrates that. Boys and girls don't really associate. And, you know, no internet, no music, no movies, no books. For a teenage kid, I know I would have been gone because I can't hold. The FLDS have a high standard of living as far as their morality, of what they want to achieve. And I think it's hard for anyone in a modern society like now. They're not far from St. George and Hurricane. They see the outside world, especially even in their town, people who aren't FLDS, they see things that they can't be a part of. And so I think it gets very hard for a young FLDS person.
Nate?
I'll talk a little bit about the education, because I've written about this recently. All the kids are homeschooled, and they're only homeschooled up to about, say, the seventh or eighth grade. I recently interviewed one young woman who's, I think, now only 18 or 19 herself. And as a teenager, she was put in charge of teaching, I think it was eighth grade boys, and she taught them math and English and priesthood history, which is basically the teachings of Joseph Smith, is what she was in charge of teaching. That was their subject matter for 4 or 5 hours a day, and then the kids would let them out about 2 o'clock, and then that was only like 9 months a year. So that was the education these kids are and were receiving then and still are now. When kids leave the FLDS, El Capitan School, which is on the Arizona side, they actually now have a special program to try to speed these kids up and get them caught up, because they're so far behind once they reach the public schools.
Let's move on to the role of women in this culture. What can you tell us, Nate?
It's just as restricted as what we described for the children. The women aren't supposed to be holding any jobs outside the home. They are probably raising not only their children, but probably other people's children too, because in the United Order, if you're deemed not worthy to be in the United Order, but you still want to keep your loyalty to the church, then your children will be reassigned to other families or shipped off elsewhere. So you've got women raising not just their children, but someone else's children too. And then who knows where the men are. The men may be kicked out. The men may be sent to work on with an FLDS company somewhere. Again, as we saw last week in the FBI raids, a lot of these women are on food stamp benefits because they're not legally married, and they need some.
They've got eight kids.
Yeah, they have lots of kids. Yeah, big families. I mean, it's not unusual at all for a woman to have eight kids and, you know, 10 kids by the time she's 40.
Yeah, when the Texas raid happened, the FLDS kind of opened up a little bit, and we got to meet a lot of people and talk to a lot of people who had been out of reach before. And there was a really interesting moment where this lawyer, a Texan who had really no experience with the FLDS, was talking to an FLDS woman, and he said, how many kids do you have? And she said, well, I have 7 girls and 7 boys. And he said, oh, no, I mean, how many kids have you given birth to? And she said, yeah, 7 girls and 7 boys. That's kind of the life of an FLDS woman is a mother, caretaker, taking care of the home. That type of big family. And like you talk about the big houses, you see these dining rooms that are just massive for families, and it's something you don't ever see in a house. It's just this three large tables where everyone eats together, or just these huge kitchens. It's really interesting to see the size and scale of it all.
Mealtime must be quite the production. We have one image up here with some graffiti that says, "Keep sweet." We hear that phrase a lot associated with FLDS. What does it mean?
It gets back to what Trent was talking about earlier about how all the FLDS are taught obedience, but women, especially if they're going up, are taught to keep sweet, which basically means smile, keep your mouth shut, and do what you're supposed to do, in so many words.
And I think it also, like, for FLDS or an LDS audience would understand this phrase to be like, we're looking forward to the next life. So be as positive as you can. Things are going to get better. I think there's a lot of that message too. But it can be seen in multiple ways.
We have so much to cover, so I'm going to speed through history a little bit. 1953, it sort of explains the FLDS relationship with government, and it's quite complicated. Arizona government came in, raided, arrested hundreds of polygamists, and obviously that has lasting effects. If you fast forward to the 2000s, then we see the Texas compound. And what were they trying to create in Texas? You referred to an earlier trend.
And the Texas YFZ Ranch, Yearning for Zion Ranch, was really their holy land. I mean, it's the only place, really the first fundamentalist temple. They built a temple there. It's a massive, massive place. And when the news came out, ranch, it seemed like this tiny little place, but we flew over it and it was huge. But this is really, when it was running, was where the best of the best, the elite of the FLDS, the royalty, basically, were there. You had to live, this was before they started their United Order, so this is where the people who were really living the higher laws would go for training and to create this Zion on Earth.
And they couldn't create that in Utah or Arizona, somewhere in the border, no?
Well, I guess they could have, but they bought this ranch as pressure was being put on them in Utah and Arizona. I mean, by this point, Warren is already being sued by some of his former members, by some of his nephews, people like that. Utah was prosecuting one of the cops for bigamy. So they were looking for somewhere else. And you know, whatever spiritual component this ranch might have had, this was also a hiding place for Warren and other men to commit crimes, specifically sex abuse. I mean, Warren built a temple and then sexually abused 12 to 15-year-old girls he purported to marry in the temple. And when Texas raided it, they found other pregnant teenagers too, been impregnated by grown men.
How was that exposed? What finally cracked that wide open?
That's a long story.
It
was a bogus tip, basically, the tip turned out to be bogus, but once the cops and the FBI got on the ranch, they found all this other stuff, got new search warrants, and just found all these records, and again, the pregnant teenagers and other evidence. And
basically, the FLDS kept very good records of everything.
Okay, so Warren Jeffs is convicted. He's sentenced to life, so he's in jail. What effect does that have on the core of the FLDS community? Because he's still revered as their leader.
Well,
isn't he?
Yes. Oh, yeah. We've heard some testimony about this recently. I mean, he's giving some orders from prison, but it also sounds like his brothers have some leeway to make some decisions. But the people are taught that Warren's salvation depends on their obedience, their spirituality. However good the Mormons, they consider themselves to be Mormons, however good Mormons they are, that's going to help Warren Jeffs escape his prison. So it impacts them in that way. The other impact is, too, that Warren will give these orders from prison, or his brothers will purport some of these orders from prison, but Warren's not actually there to suffer any of the consequences. That, you know, he doesn't see the hungry women and children. He doesn't see the family separated and stuff like that.
Did it change the community, at least from the outside? Could you see how behaviors were changing at all in the community, Trent, when you went and visited post-arrest and conviction?
Well, like I said, the Texas raid kind of opened things up, because the FLDS realized, like in the 53 raid, one of the things that turned public opinion around was the photos of families being, quote, ripped apart, you know. And so I think after the Texas raid, there was a lot of instances where people were open and people were talking. And then things closed down again. And there was kind of a wave of people who, when the UO started, a wave of people kind of left the FLDS, including some top people who had helped run the whole Warren Jeffs, you know, era. And they left and said, we're done, we've seen the evidence, or, you know, they all had different reasons for leaving. But so in a way, the town opened up, but it wasn't the FLD. The FLDS were closing down, and the people who had left were opening up. And usually what we see, these people who leave the group, there's about a year that it takes for them to process what just happened. Their whole religion, their whole life, their heritage just explodes. And it takes them about a year, and then after that year period or so, they kind of come to grips with their new reality, and that's usually when they'll start to, you know, talk or tell their stories, and we can get some information about what's going on.
Now, after Texas, after Warren Jeffs, that certainly intensified government scrutiny on this community. And so tell us a little bit about the United Effort Plan Trust. When the state of Utah stepped in and started to look at the financial assets of this community, can you explain what the United Effort Plan is, first of all?
Sure. Well, remember earlier I mentioned that the FLDS believe in a communal form of living. And most of the real estate in Hilldale and Colorado City belonged to this land trust called the United Effort Plan. It was constituted back in the 1940s. And so you may have lived in the same house in Hilldale and Colorado City 20, 30, 40 years, but you didn't actually own that house. This land trust owned the house. And you were just kind of a caretaker of it. And some people were reassigned houses based on need. I mean, if you were an elderly couple and you didn't have many kids around anymore, you might have been moved out of your big house into a smaller house and a young family would go in, that sort of thing. And also, of course, if you were out of favor with the church, you could lose your house too. Well, about 2004, again, as Warren starts to get sued by people he's kicked out and people, nephews who say he molested them, they start suing. Warren doesn't answer any of the lawsuits. They sued the United Effort Plan. It doesn't answer any of the lawsuits. And there was a risk that what's called a default judgment would be entered, which basically means, well, you didn't rebut any of this, so we're going to award everything to the plaintiffs. And the state of Utah was worried that would lead to people losing their homes. So the state of Utah went to court, asked a judge to appoint basically a receiver to take charge of this trust. And the plan was, you know, a few months, maybe a year or so, Utah would run this, and then we'd be out of it. 11 years later, Utah is still running this trust. So Utah pretty much owns and manages polygamous property down on the Utah-Arizona Strip and in British Columbia, Canada, because the trust held property up there as well. So there's Canadian property managed by the state of Utah at this moment.
And the way the state is managing it now is trickling into the society. It's affecting how people live where they live, right?
Yeah, that's right. First of all, of course, Utah's been trying to run this trust in a secular manner, and that's proved difficult because the FLDS does not like Utah being involved. They've told their members not to cooperate with the fiduciary who runs it. They're not supposed to be signing any of the occupancy agreements, which are basically rental agreements. They're not supposed to be paying the $100 a month occupancy fee, which is kind of like their version of a homeowner's fees. One of the issues that's been in this civil lawsuit that's down in Phoenix is that the towns have resisted efforts to subdivide the property. In Colorado City still, you have entire town blocks. They're still listed as one parcel at the county recorder's office. So there could be eight houses on that parcel, but it's just one parcel. And UEP would like to subdivide those to help so they can start giving away homes to people. And Colorado City has been resisting that, and it's in litigation right now in the courts in Arizona. That similar litigation happened on the Utah side, and it took a Utah Supreme Court decision in order to get the subdivision done.
Now, Trent, you noted that some non-FLDS members, or they may still consider themselves to be affiliated with the church, but they've been kicked out or whatever, that population is increasing, and part of that is because of these subdivisions. It's allowing them to actually find a place to live. Right?
Oh, yeah. So you have people in town who spent their whole life in town, building homes. Every Saturday, people would get together and do these work projects where they go, you know, I've seen a time-lapse video online where they build a house in 24 hours from foundation to finish. I mean, it's incredible the amount of production that can occur with this community. And so a lot of these kids grow up, they leave the group, but they still they're a beneficiary of the trust. They still have earned a place to have a home or to have a property. And so they're now applying to the state and saying, hey, I lived there, I helped build all these things, or I contributed this many hours. And the state is saying, yeah, the state is deciding who gets to do this. And since none of the FLDS seem to be really interested in cooperating in any way with the government, they're kind of being pushed out of this process through evictions and other things, and quote, apostates is what a lot of these people will call themselves who've left the FLDS. They're getting homes and they're moving in, and we've even seen there's a city block wide walled compound where Lyle Jeffs, Warren's brother, has his houses, and there's a whole city block compound. Well, the UEP just gave one of the homes on that walled compound to an apostate.
Within the wall.
Right, within the wall. So they had to build another wall, walling off that wall. And now when you drive by, the gates are open up for that one house, but all the other gates are still shut, you know, secure. So it's really, really fascinating.
It is. I guess you look at the big homes, you look at the development, and you say to yourself, if this is all communally owned, where is the money coming from? How is the church making all of its money? And you did a 7-month investigation into a construction company. It had FLDS. Was it owned by the church, or was it just run by the church? What did you find out?
I don't know that there's a difference at this point. I mean, it technically it has individuals listed as owners, but all the evidence is it's lock, stock, and barrel run by the church. And it's called Phase Concrete. It also does some business under the name Jack Daniels Construction. It has nothing to do with whiskey. Two FLDS men named Jack and Dan started their own construction company and decided to call it Jack Daniels Construction. But they merged with Phase, and mostly they do concrete, as name implies, and they will do foundations and parking structures and all manner of concrete and industrial and commercial. All over the country. These photos Trent took, we found them pouring concrete for a new high school in Rawlings, Wyoming. So that's a public project. They also do a lot of Walmarts and Super Walmarts and Sam's Clubs. They've done those Walmart stores really all over the West. We found that Jack Daniels had worked as far east as Louisiana. And a lot of these jobs, turns out the concrete job on a Walmart can pay up to $3 million. And so that those proceeds can go to the church. But then also, they've got FLDS men and often boys working as well, and they're supposed to be donating their paychecks to the church.
So your reporting noted that often they have two sets of books.
Yes.
One that's the official and then one that's the donated time.
Yeah. Yeah. So they'll turn one into government to pay the payroll tax, or if it's a public job, some states have prevailing wage laws, or a federal job, prevailing wage laws. They'll turn those into the government. But then, as you said, there's a separate set, and the men will give, they'll turn most of their paychecks into the church, and they'll be given kind of this receipt so the church can keep track of how much each man or boy has donated from their wages to the church.
The record keeping, that might be their undoing. But nothing that they're doing is illegal, is it?
I'm not a lawyer, so I can tell you that they've not been...
Raise the eyebrows of any regulators.
They've not been charged, that I'm aware, with any crimes or any violations of labor law. They've been cited a few times by OSHA for safety violations, but probably not any more than the average construction company. Does break the law? Well, I don't know if I want to touch that one. We'll see we'll see if the government ever takes any action with it. There have been some other FLDS-related companies that have had the government come after them.
So. Well, let's go to one that I think is still waiting for a ruling from the judge. It involves some farming, and the U.S. Department of Labor is concerned about underage labor on this farm.
Yeah. So this, I don't know if Trent took this one too. This is a pecan farm near Hurricane, and a company called Paragon Contracting Corp. had a contract to harvest these pecans. Back in 07, Paragon, which is an FLDS controlled company, got caught using kids as laborers. So they reached an agreement with the U.S. Department of Labor that said in the district courts to not use child laborers anymore, to not use children in ways that violate labor laws. But then 5 years later, there's a video that surfaces of another pecan harvest here, and there's kids out there harvesting pecans. So U.S. Department of Justice launches another big investigation, and now this time there's a lot more witnesses because a lot of the kids and parents who worked on these harvests are now witnesses for the government. So right now there's a federal judge here in Utah that is weighing whether Paragon broke the earlier agreement, and if so, it could be held in contempt of court for violating that agreement to not use child laborers in ways that break the law.
How big is this pecan farm, Trent?
What do you think, about 4 football fields?
Yeah, probably, and I don't think the FLDS owned the pecan farm. I think they were just the contractors to harvest it.
And in the video, which is somewhere on YouTube, it's not like there's a few kids on a ladder. I mean, this field is filled. It's like school recess. It is filled with kids.
Funny you say school recess, because there was evidence they actually closed the schools so the kids could go harvest the pecans.
Okay, we'll be waiting for that decision. Another decision is pending. And in fact, a case that has been argued, I think, the last 7 weeks down in Phoenix was in closing arguments today. We don't know when it's going to go to the judge. Have they finished their closing arguments?
I think they finished closing arguments today, and I think I assume the jury went home for the night, but I think the jury's deliberating right now.
But you alluded to this earlier. The case involves the town governments of Hilldale and Colorado City being controlled by the church, essentially, right?
Yes. It's a discrimination lawsuit filed by the Justice Department, and they're alleging that the town governments have discriminated against people who are not FLDS, discriminated against them on the basis of housing and through police inaction or inaction. So there's two claims. One relates to housing, the other relates to policing. And testimony's gone about 7 weeks with a couple breaks during that because the judge got sick at one point and some stuff like that. So,
but some pretty interesting testimony.
Yeah.
We've got an image here of one of the women who testified, Charlene Jeffs. Now, who is she?
Charlene Jeffs is the now ex-wife of Lyle Jeffs, who is the bishop of Short Creek. And she is an interesting witness because we don't know that there's ever been a legal wife of someone so high-ranking testifying against the sect before.
What'd she say?
Well, she said that they had a happy life until Warren took over the sect, and then there were lots of problems. Warren started banning contact among spouses and stuff like that, and so all the affection was gone out of marriages and some things like that. She talked about some of the things she saw Lyle do over the years in terms of helping Warren escape law enforcement, and then also some of the things Lyle did to help the towns. You know, he told one man he ought to go be a town marshal, which is one of the central allegations from the Justice Department that the church picks who gets to be a marshal in the town.
Essentially a cop.
Yeah, sorry. The cops down there are called marshals. So who gets to be the town cops? And there was testimony about these legal meetings they'd have on Saturday. At one point, there was so much litigation between all the towns and the church and stuff like that. Just every Saturday, the representatives from the town government and the church and some of the other components would all meet in an office and talk about these legal strategies and how to coordinate between different parties and stuff like that. Because again, they were looking for ways to stifle the United Effort Plan and some of the things they were wanting to do, like subdivide the towns, and they were also talking about how to deal with like some of the Texas child welfare cases and things like that. So Lyle Jeffs would be in some of these meetings, according to the testimony, and with the town mayor and stuff like that.
We actually scheduled tonight's meeting around, we thought that a verdict would come down in this case already. Sadly, the judge got sick, so things got delayed a little bit. But so what would happen if the judge finds that these towns are run by the church? What could possibly be the penalty there?
Well, first, the jury has to find that there was discrimination. And then the jury could also set some damages. But if the jury finds discrimination, then the Justice Department can go to the judge and ask for what's termed injunctive relief, which is basically the federal government laying out what they want the judge to impose on the towns to fix the problems. And so the government hasn't said yet what it's going to ask for, but everyone assumes the first thing they're going to ask for is for the town marshals to be dissolved, like the police force broken up. Some of the things they could potentially ask for would be things like a monitor appointed to monitor the town finances and oversee some of the hiring processes to make sure there's a secular process for hiring people who could make sure that they're following public meeting laws, because that's been an issue too, that they're holding secret meetings in violation of the state's meeting laws, and that's leading to discrimination. Probably the most common examples we have here is school desegregation cases. Sometimes the judge will appoint a monitor, and the judge will keep track of, and the monitor can report to the judge if the monitor doesn't think the government's, municipal governments are following the judge's instructions and stuff like that. We could see something like that here with Hilldale and Colorado City.
So major changes for these two towns.
Yeah, it would be major.
Before we get to Q&A, finally, the raid last week, 11 arrests, including the Bishop of Short Creek, Lyle Jeffs, who is effectively the day-to-day leader of this church. What are the charges facing these individuals again?
There are two counts of conspiracy. One is conspiracy with the food stamp program. The other is conspiracy to launder money. And one penalty carries up to 5 years, the other up to 20 years, I forget which is which. But there's 11 defendants, so two of Warren's full brothers are charged, and so is another high-ranking man in the church, a business owner down there named John Wayman. And it's unusual, too, because two women have been charged, and there have not been very many women prosecuted for crimes with underpinnings in polygamy in the long history of Utah.
You've got a great story on that in this morning's paper, sltrib.com, if you haven't read it. One more last thing I wanted to get to, because this really has affected the town fundamentally, were the devastating floods from last year, killing 13 people in this tiny community, women and children, such a tragedy. Describe the devastation that you saw when you went down there, Trent.
Well, you know, the video of the flash flood is just heartbreaking to see. You can actually watch it happen, and just terrible. And in fact, here's a scene here of the two cars still in the wash. It seemed almost that they had left these cars there and actually told the people in the town to go look at it, because there was a constant parade of people coming to look and kind of get that warning, okay, we got to be careful next time and so forth. But you saw the town fill up with government agencies, with FLDS people, and the former FLDS, the apostates kind of people. Everybody searching, working together, kind of let's find these victims, let's search, see what we can do, let's help each other out. There was a real coming together. And I mean, it's not a happy ending necessarily. It's not everything's great and fine. They all work together. This was a special circumstance. So it's hard to say that everything's healed up and everyone is friends again. But this was a rare moment where you saw a lot of good come out of everybody and working together for that. And
what about the relationship with government? Were the FLDS people, who were very secretive, very suspicious of government officials, how did they accept the help?
A lot of them did. I mean, a lot of that interaction was between town officials in Hilldale and Colorado City with those outside agencies, like the two sheriff's offices, like the Utah Department of Emergency Management, with the Utah National Guard. I don't know that a lot of the rank and file FLDS had a lot to do with those outside government agencies, but I've not heard there are any cooperation problems amongst the government agencies.
As this community changes, I mean, you're watching it before your eyes. The public schools are filling up with kids. Non-FLDS people are moving into FLDS blocks, and yet the walls are still constructed. I mean, what is this community going to be in 5 years? What do you think?
Well, I think we've already started to see a real splintering out of the FLDS finding new places, finding other places. You know, we hear that kind of Short Creek is done, and it's been years that they've been kind of spreading out to places like Mancos, Colorado, Pringle, South Dakota, the Texas. YFZ was, I think, started around 2004. I mean, so they've been kind of splintering out into different places, and there are a lot of places that we don't know about, and some that we know about we haven't reported on yet. I mean, there's just a lot of trying to connect the dots has been really difficult, but there definitely seems to be a scattering of the group into different areas.
As you noted, when Warren Jeffs was convicted, there was sort of an exodus of members from the church. Are we seeing that this time around too?
I would say it's been a gradual exodus. I mean, it wasn't like everyone got up once and left, because a lot of people still don't know what he did, what he was convicted of. They're actually forbidden from learning anything that went on in Texas. There was just last week in some of the testimony on whether one of the food stamp fraud suspects should remain in jail, when one of the former FLDS took the witness stand, a couple of the current FLDS got up and left the room. And then as soon as he was done testifying, they came back in. And I suspect that's because they know they're not supposed to be hearing about anything Warren did. And every time there's any testimony like that, it comes back to Warren eventually. So so what you hear from a lot of folks is that, you know, I didn't know what Warren did, or, you know, I learned late and I couldn't leave because I had my, you know, spouses and kids still in. I didn't want to leave them or something like that. I don't know that Hilldale and Colorado City will ever be a conventional American community, if there is such a thing. And some people, even those who have left Warren, don't want it to ever be. I mean, there are people who left Warren and advocate for returning the towns to 1942, literally, when the United Effort Plan was drawn up. They want to go back to that communal form of living. And I don't think that's ever going to happen either. I do think you're going to see that in some ways the divide's going to get a little worse as more non-FLDS take some of these UEP homes, because they're the only ones applying for it. But I also don't see much of a future for the FLDS church itself. It's not going to go away overnight, but I don't know where it goes under the current leadership, if that's
Trent,
what you want to call it.
Yeah, and it seems like what you notice happening is the people who are staying are the truest true believers. If some of the restrictions, like we showed a photo of these three girls who left a few years ago that we did a story on that was very fascinating. There had been no marriages in the town in the community for several years. They were in their mid-20s, and so they're like, what's our future? So they left, and they just got tired of it. You know, it was those are my words, but so what you end up having now is the true believers, the diehards, in effect, staying with the group getting even, you know, stronger, and the people who are kind of lost their patience or lost their beliefs, having doubts, leaving. So it almost like ratchets it up for the FLDS, in my opinion.
And Warren maintains his leadership. It's so fascinating to me to see all of these things happening and people still cling to him. And he's a prolific writer, and he's still issuing edicts all the time from prison.
Yeah, and what you have to remember with that is, if you're in the group, or say you're out of the group, you leave the group, you're leaving behind the religion you grew up with, you're leaving behind often your family, you're leaving your home, you're leaving your source of income or food possibly. I mean, you're leaving everything. And for some of these people who've left, they tell us they come out and they have no education. They don't know anyone in the outside world. They've been taught that the outside world is evil and that they should avoid it. So to come out is, it's easy for kind of us on the outside world to say, oh yeah, I could move to Tooele, or I could move here or there. But for these people, especially the young people, it's almost impossible to fathom it.
It's time for your questions. We'd love to hear from some of the people here in the audience. If you've got questions, wait for the microphone.
Years ago, I heard about this, I don't know if you'd call it a trend, but this situation with the Lost Boys, the teenage boys sometimes being kicked out of the community. Is that still going on as far as you can see? Is that not going on anymore?
Yeah, I mean, there's fewer teenage boys than there used to be, but yeah, I mean, they still get kicked out for probably the same reasons they used to get kicked out. Again, you're not supposed to be listening to media, like outside media, whether it be movies or songs or anything like that. I mean, just the good old-fashioned average teenager is rebellious, right? You know, he's going to try to do not what you want him to do. And then these boys have all these extra restrictions, and they might literally be slaving away at some FLDS business and stuff, too. And there was a case in Idaho here about a year and a half ago where they found 9 FLDS boys living in a house up there. They'd been sent away on a repentance mission. And from reading the police transcripts of these interviews, like, they couldn't wait for the cops to show up. Like, they were getting a couple lousy meals a day, and the caretaker wasn't around much, and they were having to pray to Warren twice a day or something like that, and it was not a fun life for any kid.
So where are they going?
What, when the boys leave?
When they leave.
There is a handful of kind of charities that help these kids now, and there's a fundraiser for one on Friday night in West Valley City called Holding Out Help. If you want to go look online for Holding Out Help, you can find out about their fundraiser Friday. There's a couple other relief agencies like that, too. There's also kind of this informal network now of all these other FLDS that have left. We met some of those last week at that food bank just north of Hilldale. There is a bit of a support system for these folks now, because almost anyone that goes out already has some family member or friend that's already out too, and a lot of those people are very generous. One thing I've noticed is the people who have left the FLDS are very forgiving of the rank and file. Once they come out, they're not forgiving of Warren, but they're forgiving of the rank and file, because they realize they were once that way too, that they were cursing at apostates and refusing to help apostates and thought the apostates were going to go to hell. And so they don't harbor grudges against any of these folks, or very seldomly do.
And how many FLDS church members are there? You keep saying that a lot of people have left. Can you quantify how many have left or how many have stayed?
No. I mean, the educated guess is, you know, 4 figures have left, but nobody knows how many are still in.
The number 10,000 has been around for the last 10 years. There's about 10,000 members, but there seems to have been a lot of people leaving, but, you know, it's hard to, there's no census. There's no one even to ask. You know, there was no one you could ask and say, how many people are in your organization? There's a wall there of silence that at least the two of us and other media encounter.
Yeah, who knows if people in the FLDS know? I mean, they kind of compartmentalize information. So maybe people at the very top have an idea of how many there are, but below that, they probably don't know.
Yeah, when the raid in Texas happened, we had a few people that we were in contact with, and one of them told us, get a photo of every FLDS member you can in Texas because we want to know who's out there. They didn't even know their family members that might have been on the ranch. There's just this, you know, these kind of opaque areas that aren't discussed.
Another question, yes.
Would one of you speak further about the business dealings? I don't understand how it isn't illegal to work, to have the double or triple books. It almost seems like slave labor, but maybe, so please speak more about that.
Okay, I'm trying to be careful because I'm not a lawyer and I'm just a journalist that's supposed to report facts. So if you think it's illegal, feel free to keep that opinion. When I spoke to the Department of Labor specifically about some of the child labor issues, about like with Phase Concrete, about kids, one kid told me, well, he's like 17 now. He told me he started working for Phase Concrete at 15, and when he was pouring concrete at a Walmart in Santa Fe, New Mexico, he was ready to go to the next step. The other guys weren't. He needed the track hoe. No one was there to run the track hoe for him, so he just hopped in and started driving the track hoe. Had never driven the track hoe before. You're supposed to get like real training before you drive a track hoe. It's not like a riding lawnmower, you know. When you look at the U.S. Department of Labor regulations for child labor, it says people under the age of 18 are not supposed to be operating dangerous equipment. And I specifically checked with the U.S. Department of Labor if a track hoe qualifies. Yes. Yes, it qualifies. So feel free to take the next leap and say it's illegal if you want. I can tell you they've never been prosecuted or fined by the government or anything for something like that. And how they've been able to get away with that for so long, I mean, hey, there's a lot of construction sites out there. There's very few inspectors, and it becomes a numbers game. I saw a video from OSHA where they went to one of these job sites in Colorado, just kind of a random inspection, and the inspector's taking video, and I can see one Phase Concrete worker's kind of head turn, and I'm willing to bet this worker was like 16 years old, and he's up on a wall, and I don't see any harness on him, like a 12-foot wall, and you know you're supposed to be harnessed or have some kind of safe something to keep you from falling at that distance, and the inspector cites them for not having the harness, but I don't see any mention of the age of that worker, and I'm betting a lot of these inspectors don't even know that they should be looking for that when they go on these job sites. I mean, they're looking just to make sure everyone has a hard hat. They're not thinking to check IDs on whether these guys are old enough.
Good question. Yeah, right here.
First of all, let me say thanks for to Nate and to the Salt Lake Tribune. I've been working full-time for the past 4 years with people coming out of the FLDS and been going to Colorado City Hilldale. That's my second home almost. I spent 20% of my time there. And I don't have a question, I just want to make a couple comments. Polygamy really is not an issue there anymore, as you know, because there are no marriages. The only polygamists I know living in that town anymore are a few people that left the FLDS a number of years ago, but all marriages have been canceled. Very seldom do you see a 17-year-old girl in that town anymore. They're gone. And the breeding operation has taken place someplace. And some don't, you know, we have a pretty good idea where it is because his top 15 men have been appointed breeders. And I just want to say, too, that my big concern at this point is the children and the food situation there. the FLDS members, there's plenty of food. As you reported, there's plenty of food. But I just want to emphasize, I'm afraid one of these days some national media organization is going to come in and take pictures of some kids with bloated bellies because the FLDS refuses, and they have orders from Warren Jeffs not to take food from anybody. And there is plenty of food. There's food in Apple Valley. There's food in Kanab. There's food with our organization down at the log building down there, which formerly was holding out help, but they refuse. And a lot of the mothers don't even have charge of their own children. The children have been taken away from mothers. The boys are living in boys' houses. Girls are living in girls' houses. And so what's going to happen is they're going to starve some of their kids, I'm afraid. And they're going to claim that there's no food anymore because the government took away the SNAP program. But there is plenty of food, but they refuse to take it from outsiders. And then another thing, the children are being severely abused. Just this past week, a little guy got out of there and walking down the highway, and somebody picked him up and got him to Salt Lake City. And this child explained to the authorities what had happened. A couple of the older brothers were beating him to a pulp. And a form of waterboarding is taking place in disciplining those children. This little guy, when he would go to sleep, then when he's sound asleep, they'd pour water over his head. And Child Protection Agency got involved in that just a couple days ago, and they sent that child back in the car with his mother and the same brother that had beat him. And so I come out of public office in Minnesota. I've been in Utah now for 14 years, but I'm pretty upset with the Attorney General's office. I'm pretty upset with the governor. I'm pretty upset with Child Protection Agency in this state that they are sending these kids back into the horrible, hellish mess where they came out of once they escaped. And so,
thank you so much. You've brought up some important issues. Talk about the Utah Attorney General's office. Are they actively prosecuting child abuse allegations? Are they looking to Child Protective Services to round up kids who are suspected to be abused?
I'm not aware of any roundups, no. I mean, the answer you always hear from not just the Utah Attorney General, but all the law enforcement with some jurisdiction down there is that, we will prosecute the crimes that are brought to us and that we can prove in court. Any abuse case is difficult to prove in court, but it's particularly difficult when you have a community that doesn't often want to be a witness. And so there's been very few prosecutions down there relative to sex abuse or child abuse or anything like that.
Do you want to speak to the food shortages?
Well, this gentleman made some good points. Another one is that the church can feed those folks if it wants to. I mean, we just talked about all the money they make and the revenue sources they have. If the church wants to give everyone a steak dinner tonight, the church can find the money to do that. It just doesn't want to for whatever reason. It wants to spend the money elsewhere.
I'll do one last question. Go ahead.
I agree with this gentleman here that there are many things that are troubling down there. But I still feel like we need to get to the core where they got into this mess in the first place. Where it all got started, and that is polygamy. We haven't really mentioned much about that here yet. I mean, as far as I understand, this is the reason why boys are getting kicked out, because they're competition. Why children and women are being severely abused in so many ways. And the only ones benefiting really are, benefiting, quote unquote, are a few chosen or elite men, older men. And I just feel like, as you know, somebody who's living here in Utah, I feel like we have a communal responsibility for this, because in a way we're all part of this. And I just want you to address some of that too.
Anyone? Nate?
What's the question?
I suppose the question is, why isn't the Attorney General, why aren't law enforcement cracking down on polygamy. And admittedly, the FLDS brand of polygamy is different from the Apostolic Brethren or other groups that practice polygamy, right?
Well, again, all the law enforcement with some jurisdiction down there say that they will investigate crimes that are brought to them in which they can then prove in court. Why there's not another raid like 1953, I suspect because the 1953 raid didn't go so well. I don't know if the public has an appetite for something like that again. The more of the discussion needs to be on these sort of related crimes, fraud, physical abuse, things like that.
I think you also see, like, I don't have an answer for you. I don't have a golden solution of any of these issues. Obviously, the allegations, like the gentleman mentioned, are very strong. And if what the people leaving the group are saying is happening is true, this is like one of the top three stories in the state right now, if that's really going on. And we have no way, we haven't verified a lot of these stories just yet. But I don't know what really, this is such a tough issue. Because the country seems to be going towards more adults can do what they want to do. Same-sex marriage is legalized. Marijuana seems to be being legalized in more and more places. So there's this movement for kind of civil liberties. But at the same time, what do we do when there's issues and in these communities? And I guess the one thing I would say, like, for this community, how they see it, there was a photo a while back on the screen of a gentleman with photos of his 34 kids on the wall. And we flew down in a big hurry the day that the bigamy law was basically defused in Utah and that bigamy was decriminalized. And we thought, this is big news. There's going to be people celebrating in the streets, or, you know, there'll be something there. And we stopped in with this gentleman who's a former FLDS member. And we said, hey, they just decriminalized polygamy. What do you think? And it was like, oh, really? They did? Okay. It was like today and tomorrow and yesterday, it's all the same. They've been living this life out of sight for their religious reasons for years, and this made no difference to this gentleman. He said, I was just at a marriage this morning, you know. It was like we had said, yeah, the sky's blue. So it doesn't really fully answer your question or your point, but that's just kind of the landscape. And, you know, there may be more investigations by the state going on. These last two situations against the FLDS and the Kingstons were federal investigations, and that's, you know, leave it up to the Utah populace to have an opinion on that. But there since Warren's trial, which the results were basically thrown out due to some judicial, you know, issues, there hasn't been much.
Nate?
I do have a story scheduled to run this weekend talking a little bit more about how they broke the fraud case with the food stamps. And when you read that story, you might take a little comfort in the apparatus that still exists to pursue some of these issues. I won't say any more than that for right now, but read the paper Sunday.
SLTrib.com. We're out of time. I just want to ask each of you, finally, not many news organizations have a polygamy beat. How is covering polygamy, how has that sort of changed your approach to reporting, Trent?
I've learned a lot, and I think I've grown a lot as a journalist. I've learned from four amazing reporters, Brooke Adams, Lindsay Whitehurst, Jim Dalrymple, and Nate. They've helped me grow a lot. But I'll tell you, this is a hard beat, especially as a photographer, because you're instantly, people don't know that necessarily Nate's a reporter if they see him, but I'm out there, the camera, they run away, and you just really, oftentimes you try and preserve their space and give people room. I guess in the end, I know that what I'm doing will be of value to them as well, but right now they hate me, or some do. I mean, it can be very touchy and challenging.
Nate?
Well, Trent's a big asset to me because he's been doing this longer than I have, and people love Trent's photography. I mean, we go down there, and people I haven't met before, they'll see Trent with his camera, and they'll walk up and go, are you Trent Nelson? Because they've been looking at Trent's photos for years, and they were looking at Trent's photos when they weren't supposed to be looking at Trent's photos, you know, when they were still in good standing with Warren, and they'd sneak around on the internet and read news websites and see Trent, and Trent's really helped open some doors for us because they've seen Trent's photography and they feel like they know Trent and like his work.
Well, tremendous work, both of you. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. Nate Carlisle, Trent Nelson, thank you all for being here and supporting the Salt Lake Tribune in this endeavor. Thank you so much. Thanks for being here.